The ghost on the parchment. That evening, Papa burst home from the Archbishop's court in a flurry. His mouth was pulled in a tight line. Vufril, Mama, and I looked up in surprise from the dining table, but it was Mama who recognized with a single glance everything in our father's expression, for she darted up from her chair to rush to his side. She took his hat before Sebastian could, then touched his shoulder to comfort him before hanging up his coat. Papa eyed the dishes on the table with a withering gaze.
"Fish again,"
he muttered. He leaned a hand against the back of his chair and shook his head, over and over, unsatisfied with something. His eyes scanned our home, searching for something he couldn't quite place. "What is it, Leopold?" my mother finally asked.
"This flat is so cramped," he complained, waving a hand in annoyance at the foyer. "I hadn't realized how small it was until we returned. Look, Anna, at how we can barely fit all our luggage in here."
"There's plenty of room, Papa," Vufril said. "I don't mind it."
"Of course you don't," Papa replied. "You were still a small boy."
It was rare to hear him short with my brother, and I leaned in, curious and intimidated. His eyes jerked to me and held my gaze.
"Nanrul, though, is turning into a young lady. And here you two are, still sharing a room."
Fear slithered cold into the marrow of my bones. I could hear the unspoken words behind it.
"The older they are, the less magnificent they seem."
I would not be a miracle child for much longer. Mama leaned over to him and put her hand on top of his. "We can certainly give Nanrul her own room," she said, still searching for the root of Papa's mood. Vufril looked at our mother in shock.
"Why?"
he asked. Mama frowned at his interruption.
"Vufril, you are 12. You cannot continue to stay in the same room as your sister. It's not proper."
My brother glanced at me, expecting me to protest. When I didn't, he tightened his lips. I could see the fear in his face at sleeping by himself, left alone to his nightmares and midnight visitors. Perhaps he was still running from Hyacinth in his dreams. I thought of the beasts that had been prowling the French countryside, and imagined the fairy boy's sharp teeth digging into my brother's flesh.
"Yes?"
Papa nodded at my mother's words.
"It's decided, then. We'll have to arrange accommodations for Sebastian in the next building. Nanrul can take his old chambers."
Vufril and I exchanged a glance. What would haunt him at night without me there? He looked down in silence at his dinner. Before my illness and what cracked us apart, he might have protested loudly. Now he twirled his fork against his dish and broke his fish into pieces. Somewhere deep in my thoughts, a figure watched him curiously with a tilted head. Mama watched Papa closely, picking up something else under his temper.
"There has been some news," she finally said. "That has been unfair to you?"
At that, Papa's shoulders sagged.
"It is absurd,"
he answered after a while.
"I received no letters, no warning at all."
"What has the Archbishop done?"
"They have stopped my salary, Anna, due to my extended absence. Now that I am back, they have lowered my pay another 50 gulden.
Mama stiffened at the revelation.
50 gulden, she breathed.
"And no reason for it?"
"Only that we have been away," Papa replied, "which he knew about in advance. He will not agree to us leaving again."
"And Herr Hagenauer?"
He rubbed the crease between his brows, as if it might come out if he did it hard enough, that it might solve his problems.
"He has agreed to give us another month to catch up on our rent. No more."
A lowered salary. Our unpaid rent. Papa's complaints about my age?
Soon my parents would need to start talking about the matter of my dowry, too, another expense to weigh down the family. I could look into my future and see my path laid out clearly before me. My father would approve of a man who I could be matched with. He would ask for my hand in marriage. I would marry, and like my mother, I would bear children to carry on my husband's name, leave my family behind for his, and look on as Wulfril headed off into the glittering world of operas and concerts and noblemen eager to commission him for his music. The thought of my predestined future made me lightheaded. I could not imagine life changing beyond what it currently was. Could not picture a time when I wouldn't be riding beside my brother in a carriage and playing before a court. I thought of my father up late at his desk, his sleeves pushed up to his elbows. Would he linger there tonight, long after we'd all gone to bed? "Perhaps you should have a talk with him," Mama was saying. "The Archbishop can be a reasonable man."
"He is still skeptical of Wulfril's talents. He says that we have no reason to be running around the courts of Europe with what he deems a...
Even the mere thought made Papa's cheeks redden in anger.
"A traveling circus."
"What does he want?"
"Proof."
Papa's face darkened even more.
"As if he has not already heard Wulfril perform and none will accompany. As if he has not already witnessed their miracles for himself, and he calls himself a man of God.
Leopold," Mama said sharply. Papa knew he had spoken too much, and his voice hushed immediately, his eyes darting once to the window, as if the Archbishop could hear his insult all the way from the court. He sighed and ran a hand through his hair.
"I have agreed to his request."
"What kind of request?" Papa looked to my brother. He seemed almost apologetic.
"The Archbishop wants to commission an oratorio from our Wulfril."
Mama studied her husband's face carefully. "This is good news, isn't it?" she asked, knowing it wasn't.
"He wants it in a week,"
Papa said. "A week?" "It's impossible," I whispered out loud, before I could catch myself. "Impossible, even for Wulfril." Across the table, Wulfril stared intently at Papa, the circles dark under my brother's eyes, his face like a burning wick with the hope of pleasing our father.
"I can do it," he said in the silence.
"Please. I already have the most wonderful harmony in mind." Mama didn't answer or disagree. We all knew that there was no use in it. Papa had not even mentioned a payment from the Archbishop for the oratorio. It meant that the payment would be Papa being allowed to keep his salary. As if he'd heard my thought, our father turned now to look at me. In his eyes, I saw the same light as on the day when he'd returned with the finished, bound volume of my music, ready to deliver it to the Princess of Orange. I didn't know what came over me then. The spirit of Hyacinth stirring in my thoughts, perhaps, or the memory of what I had demanded from him? The recklessness of already having lost and knowing I could not lose more. Anger that had been waiting in some corner of me, waiting for the right time to emerge. I tilted my chin high, my eyes on my father's, and held his gaze like a challenge. He raised an eyebrow in surprise, but I did not back down. What could he do to me now, anyway? I'd been through the worst already. My life was charted before me, and there was little I could do to stop it. What difference did it make now for me to push back? So I did not lower my stare. With it, I said, "You know what you want to ask of me. And if I help him, you will have to acknowledge my music, my true talent. You will have to admit what you did." My father looked away first. Mama tried to console him by putting her hands on his shoulders and whispering something close to his ear. He would have none of it.
"I am retiring to our room,"
he said. Before Mama could respond, he had brushed past her and hurried off in the direction of their bedchamber, his dinner forgotten. Later that night, Papa called me into the music room and whispered to me by candlelight.
"Nonril,"
he said, his voice strangely subdued.
"Vulfril cannot finish such a work in 8 days."
"I know," I replied, because it was true, and sat calmly with my hands in my lap, a shawl draped about my shoulders. I could tell my father wanted me to offer my help willingly, suggest that I work with my brother. Instead, I was silent. My eyes stayed level with his, willing him to ask first. I had summoned the strength to challenge him earlier. I could not back down now. Papa hesitated, his hands fidgeting restlessly. He was weary, the lines on his face pronounced tonight. He kept searching for the right words to say. I watched his eyes settle again and again on the window. Even though I knew he could not possibly be seeing Hyacinth, I still felt the hairs rise on the back of my neck, could sense the fairy's presence in the room. Finally, I said, "What does this have to do with me, Papa?" For an instant, my father's eyes softened at me, and with their softness I felt myself lean instinctively closer to him, trying to remember this rare moment.
"You write in a style not unlike your brother's," he replied at last.
His words were not stern, but reluctant, as if he was voicing a thought he had kept quiet for a long time. The silence in the room weighed against us. I stayed frozen, unsure how to respond. His words echoed through me like a bell. This was it. His admission of what I'd done. I wrote like my brother. I wrote. It was an acknowledgement of my volume of sonatas. Papa was telling me, without saying it directly, that he knew that music was mine. The quiver of candlelight trembled against my folded hands, disguising the shudder that coursed through my body.
"How do you know this?" I asked him quietly.
"Nonril,"
he replied, his eyes fixed on mine.
"You know how."
"You know how." I looked around the music room, its shadows stretched and shaking from the candles. Any doubt I might have felt over what had happened now fell away. Here, at last, was his admission that he had indeed taken my music with intention, had put my brother's name on my work and published it. "Why didn't you tell me?" I said.
"Would it have made any difference?"
he mumbled.
"Except to make you miserable sooner. Would you have fought me? It is the way it is."
He did not like coming to me like this, vulnerable in admitting to me the truth. I found myself thrilled by his discomfort. For once, I was not the one apologizing to my father, seeking his approval, trying to find a way to appease him. Now it was his turn. I let him shift, his eyes first meeting mine, and then darting away in frustration, trying to settle on anything else but my unspoken accusation. "Why do you do all of this, Papa?" I asked. "Our lessons, our tour, sacrificing your own standing with the Archbishop, what is the reason for it? I know it is about the money, but that cannot be the whole of it." His posture was stiff and hunched, his fingers woven against each other. I waited patiently until he finally found his response.
"Do you know what I thought I would become, Nonril?"
When I shook my head, he said,
"A missionary. My parents thought me a future priest, but my calling was a divine one."
He was silent a moment.
"For a long time, I thought that my entire purpose in life had been to become a missionary, and that I had failed it. Music and composition, I am good at it, but I am no lasting figure.
He looked down at the creases in his hands.
Then I heard you and your brother at the clavier. I knew what God had put me on this earth to do. In a way, I have become a missionary. There is no greater purpose for me than to ensure that you are heard by as many as possible.
I studied his bowed head and realized how old he looked. In that moment, I felt sorry for him. I believed my father, but I did not think he understood himself as well as he thought. He wanted me to be heard, but not by name. He wanted me to be seen, but not for what I could create. And he thought himself a missionary, an ambassador of God, when what he really wanted was to validate himself. The satisfaction I'd felt earlier at his admission and his vulnerability began to fade. I'd gotten what I wanted from him. Now, as I stared at his aging face in the candlelight, all I wanted to do was shake my head. Underneath, his harsh exterior was just a pitiful man mired in insecurity. I sighed. The thought of dragging this on suddenly brought me no joy. "I'll help him," I said. My father glanced up at me, surprised. "I'll help him," I repeated. "It will be hard, but we can do it." Papa opened his mouth, closed it, and searched my gaze. He did not smile. I waited, wondering if I might catch a glimpse of guilt, some semblance of an apology on his face. But he had already admitted too much for one night. In the next instance, he leaned back and furrowed his brows.
"Of course you will," he said.
The authority had returned to his voice just as I had retreated to my meek position, the daughter at his command.
"I want you and Vulfril to do nothing else in these 8 days, to go nowhere until you have finished the oratorio. I will check on you both twice a day, at morning and at night, and your mother will bring you food. If Vulfril tires, you will take his place."
"Yes, Papa."
"I cannot have the Archbishop thinking that Vulfril does not deserve the reputation he has earned across Europe. You understand this, of course, Nunral."
I nodded. My father tightened his lips in approval, and then he rose from his chair with a single motion. I rose with him, watching him move out of the candlelight and back into the shadows of his bedchamber. When he disappeared, I turned away. I had not bothered to ask if my name would appear next to Vulfril's on the oratorio's title. My father locked Vulfril and I together in the music room the following morning, with nothing but fresh sheets of paper and quills and ink and our clavier. We were not to leave until nighttime. In a way, I was relieved. Hyacinth had always been able to find his way to us, but somehow, trapped in this room, I felt like even he might be unable to unlock a door that my father had secured himself. And even though Vulfril and I still hung in an uneasy place, at least here we could speak only with music. It was the original secret we shared between us, the ability to hear a world that others could not. Vulfril said little about why we were working together, but he seemed relieved too by my presence. He sat beside me at the clavier stand, his body turned unconsciously toward mine as he settled on a tune, the key and the tempo. He sang part of the harmony to me so that I would know what he wanted, and then he started to write out the first violin lines. Vulfril had become faster at composing, if not for his growing experience, then for the stress that Papa placed on him. He wrote in a non-stop fury until he had completed 3 lines of continuous music. And then he paused. He looked at me and pointed out the phrases as he hummed. I watched his thin hands at work. He was very pale this morning, and his dark lashes stood out against the white skin. "We'll start with arpeggios," he said to me. His hands floated across the paper. "Slow, and then grand, with other strings below it." He paused to scribble more notes below the ones he had already written.
With an undercurrent of notes to fill out the harmony.
A flute, I said, after I watched him write out the second violins. To carry your melody above the strings. He nodded without looking at me. The music had already taken away his focus on anything else. I went on, writing the lines for the flute and the horns. As I did, I noticed a shift in our styles, where his flowing melody met the abrupt sounds of my harmony. It was a subtle difference, so small that those unfamiliar with our work might never know. Wufferl would, though. He could distinguish what we wrote even when others could not. I stared at the parchment. It was as if I were looking at a ghost of myself on the page. I was here, the harmony said. When I started writing again, I did not change my style. I let it stay mine, the flutes and the horns. Every flourish, every trill and arpeggio. It was distinctly different from Wolfril's work, but to me it still matched the piece, made it whole. And perhaps no one would ever recognize my hand in this, no one would clap for me when it was performed. But my brother would see it, know it for what it was. So would my father. Papa will tell me to fix it, I thought. This piece was not my own to do what I wanted. But I left it anyway. Wufferl paused from his work on the strings to read over what I had written. I peered at him from the corner of my eye, wondering if he would tell me to change it too, if our father's voice would come out of his throat. I knew he saw the shift in our styles. But a beat of time passed, and he said nothing. Finally, he sighed. Oh, Nunral, he said. It was not an exclamation of exhaustion or exasperation, nor was it some desperate attempt for him to win me back, empty praise in the hopes of an affectionate response, or even some trick from Hyacinth with words laced in cunning. In his voice, I heard a yearning that reminded me of our younger days, when he would sit in the morning sun and lean his head against my shoulder, watching in wonder while I played. It was love for what I'd written. When I looked more closely at him, I could see tears at the corners of his eyes as he read my music over and over, as if playing it repeatedly in his head. He didn't look at me, so he couldn't see the softness that came briefly over my face, the small smile that touched my lips. He nodded at the measures, then bent his head again and continued on without a word. I felt the burden on my chest, there for so long since my illness, shift, turn lighter. His dark hair had grown into a longer tail tied at the nape of his neck. His feet still dangled a short distance above the floor, as they had when he was a child. As I stared at him, I felt a certain pity for this little creature, caught by a different limb, in the same snare as me. Nunral, he said after a while. I paused in my writing to look at him. Yes, I said. He hesitated, then spoke again. Thank you. For helping me, was the part of his sentence that remained unspoken. In that moment, I thought he might address what happened with my sonatas. I halted in my work to look at him, my heart quickening, waiting for him to say it. Would he? The seconds dragged on. I realized that I was hoping he would, so that we could bring this ugly scar between us out into the open. Wufferl's shoulders seemed weighed down. He wrote a few more measures in silence before he spoke.
I saw Hyacinth last night, in my dream, he said softly.
I hadn't heard Wufferl mention the kingdom in months. Even hearing his name on my brother's lips seemed to chill the air. What did he want? I asked.
He runs after me, Wolfril said. He looked pensive now, and weary.
I cannot escape him.
He lingers now that I am alone.
The cold prickled my skin. Hyacinth was here, in our home. What was he telling my brother?
If you're afraid, I said to him, you can come to me. I won't tell anyone.
He nodded once, but his expression looked pale and unsure. There was more to Vulfril's story. I could sense it. But he just kept writing, the light feverish in his eyes. We wrote late into the night, until Vulfril collapsed in exhaustion against the clavier stand. I helped clean his hands of ink stains, and then carried him to his room before retiring to my own. There, unable to sleep, hollow from the absence of my brother beside me, I lay awake and let my heart burn from what Hyacinth wanted with my brother. Vulfril was in danger. I could sense it now, the ice hanging in the air waiting for him. Hyacinth was coming for him, somehow, some way, and I didn't know how to protect him. I turned to my side and stared at where moonlight painted a silver square against the floor. Would he climb through my brother's window in the night while we slept? When would he do it? How? The darkness in me, the someone else that I had felt in my chest, stirred now. It painted for me a vision of Vulfril whispering to Papa about where my compositions had been hidden. Have you already forgotten? The voice reminded me. Why do you protect him? I tossed and turned, haunted by what the fairy might do, until I finally heard my door creak quietly open to reveal Vulfril stealing into my room. He hesitated by the door, not uttering a word. How did he still look so small? I stayed silent for a moment, unwilling to invite my brother inside. But then I pictured Vulfril alone in his room, listening for Hyacinth to appear. I waved him over. Come here, I said. He crawled into my bed and snuggled beside me, just like he used to. His small body trembled. I brushed my fingers through his hair and let the voice in me slowly fade. There Vulfril stayed, listening to my humming, until he finally drifted into a dreamless sleep.